you so much for coming tonight to Porches of Adherence. My name is Christian Reichert. I'm the co-director of the Johns Hopkins Adherence Research Center, and we will be having a very exciting evening tonight. So our learning objectives are here. They've been scrolling through all evening, so I'm not going to take the time to read them right now. Need to disclose that I have consulted to Gilead Science Incorporated for the development of the CF RISE program. Oh, well, thank you. It's a good program. And this session was supported by an educational grant from Gilead Science to Johns Hopkins, but Gilead was not involved in the creation of any of this content. Now, we're going to start with a couple presentations to just make sure everybody is oriented and fully trained up to listen to these vignettes. So we're going to start with Cindy George. She's the Senior Director of Patient Engagement at the CF Foundation.
Good evening, everyone. It's wonderful to be here with you tonight. I'm going to, in this first section, see if I can get this to change, talk about what is adherence. And basically, I'm setting the stage for the rest of tonight's talk. And so what we're going to discuss in this brief section is defining the current state of adherence to CF therapies and discussing the impact of adherence to CF treatments on health outcomes. So we want to start out by having a shared understanding of what is adherence, how do we define it, because many times there's different words or terms or definitions that are associated with it. So we've chosen the World Health Organization's definition from their World Initiative on Adherence to Long-Term Therapies. And this talks about, specifically I think it's relevant to CF because it goes beyond just medication. It talks about the extent to which a person's behavior, taking medicines, following a diet, or executing lifestyle changes corresponds with agreed recommendations. And I just want to point out that with this definition, the agreed recommendations, a key principle to that is having to have an active partnership with your patients, families, and care providers. And I think that's what you're going to hear about as we go along tonight. So as we have suspected, adherence is very important, and research is showing us, really, that if you follow a prescribed treatment regimen, that's going to enable better health. And so adherence now is a link to better health outcomes, as some research we're going to look at. So it is associated with fewer pulmonary exacerbations, higher lung function, and lower healthcare costs. And really, as science advances, this topic becomes even more critical, because especially for the young kids who may not have complications with CF and actually may never have it if we are taking our medications as prescribed. So the next few slides I want to show you are taken from a study done by Dr. Quittner and colleagues, and this was published in CHEST in 2014. And this really illustrates those points of the impact of importance of adherence. And this is looking at adherence as measured by medication possession ratio, or MPR, and that's on your vertical axis. And MPR, really, it comes from pharmacy refill data, and it is a reflection of what medication really basically is picked up. And I just want to make a comment again about Dr. Quittner's research here that I failed to do in the beginning, is that she went through retrospective pharmacy claims data for over 3,000 patients with cystic fibrosis, and that's about the largest sample size so far to date on adherence, CF adherence research. So it's pretty significant what we're seeing. And so this is showing us adherence to the various pulmonary medications, and you can see that there's a wide range of adherence for each medication. But in particular, if you look at the last, I'm just going to use my, hope the animation works. There we go. And that bar, this is composite of the individual drug MPRs. And if you can see there that there's a white bar, that's indicating the median, so it's about 50%. It's really roughly telling us that about half of prescribed medications for pulmonary meds are taken. And it didn't really matter whether they, as in the middle, are inhaled antibiotics or, on the very first column, an oral pill. Adherence still varied. The study also showed us by looking at adherence by age, and as you can see, adherence really fluctuated across all age groups, but you noticed a decline particularly with adolescents and young adults. Now let's look at adherence and the impact on health outcomes. This is data from Dr. Eakin, And here she's really showing, again, composite NPR and an association with pulmonary exacerbations. And pretty much you can see here that the more courses of IV antibiotics that an individual had, the lower their rate of adherence. And in this study, it also there was correlation between lung function and adherence. If you had higher adherence, you had higher lung function in this study. So it's telling us that, obviously, adherence is mattering. And so back to Dr. Quintner's study, low adherence is now also associated with higher healthcare costs. And when you can see, this is measured by, again, the composite NPR with the healthcare dollars. The blue bar is the low NPR, and that's 50% and under. The red is moderate, that's a 50 to 80%. And then the green is a high adherence, which is 80 to 100%. And you can see here that the lower prescription refill rate is associated with much higher healthcare costs. And so because this is such a critical issue for the individuals with cystic fibrosis, the CF Foundation in its 2013 strategic plan included adherence as one of the objectives. And this slide is depicting that the multi-pronged approach that we are taking. And it's really showing you here that it's a community effort. We're bringing the community together to address the situation. We're looking at patient and provider communication. We're looking to find suitable and accurate assessments through objective measures. And then we're also looking to test and find an array of interventions that would help to equip people with CF and their families so that they can achieve optimal health and ultimately their life goals. And I would tell you that perhaps some of you have heard that we originally called this program Patient Engagement, but more recently, with the community's help, we've just changed our name to Partnerships for Sustaining Daily Care Program because it really gets at the essence, like we're all working together over this topic. So, as we know, this is a very complicated disease and a complicated therapy in which to manage day-to-day. And we've been talking a lot with individuals with CF and their parents, and these are just a handful of comments that they've been making. And you can see that there's many reasons why people may have a difficult time sustaining the care day in and day out. Stress, time, balancing other life activities. And I think you're going to see that tonight as we go along with the case studies. Thank you very much.
So thank you, Cindy. So my job now is to give some context to how we can conceptualize non-adherence so that as you're looking at the vignettes that we're going to show soon, you can think about, as you're listening to what's being said, how can I conceptualize this? How do I know where to start? And adherence is incredibly complex, and there's many, many reasons why, and this is really an incredible oversimplification of it, but it does really help you figure out what direction to head. Because if you just, you know, there's three roads, not a thousand roads, because if there were a thousand roads, you wouldn't know where to go. And so there's typologies. There's unwitting, which is the patient, the care team. They all think that the patient is doing what's supposed to be done, but maybe there's a misunderstanding somewhere. Maybe I'm only doing it once a day, but I was supposed to do it twice a day. Or I was only supposed to do it until I felt better, and then I stopped. And so it's not on purpose. It's really just I didn't get it. There's erratic adherence, which is the patient understands and really agrees and really wants to do therapy, but has the trouble consistently maintaining routine. And some folks are just not organized and not planners, and so it's really hard to just put that in and make it happen every day. And then there's rationalized non-adherence. And this is in quotes because it doesn't mean it's necessarily rational. It means that they've come up with a reason why. They rationalize to themselves why. And the patient deliberately alters or discontinues. So there's many reasons for that. I don't think it's working for me. I don't feel any better when I take it. I'm depressed or I deserve the weekend off. All sorts of things can contribute to this. And once you've picked the typology, you now need to figure out what to do. And again, there's 1,001 different things you could possibly do, but when you're in the clinic and you need to keep things going, the rubber mnemonic is a pretty useful way to go. And it starts with reviewing the regimen. So what does the patient say they're taking? What do they think they're supposed to be doing? To make sure that we're all on the same page of what's happening. Does the patient understand? So the next one is understanding. Do they understand why? Why is it important to take a certain drug? What is this drug doing for me? Why am I supposed to eat higher fat when my friends aren't? And why, how, what? Then there's beliefs, and this is a really key one. What do they believe? Do they think the medication works? Do they have worries or concerns about side effects, implications for their social life, stigma, burden? What are goals and values, and how does adherence fit in there? And then you have the sort of more concrete barriers. Are there financial, personal, social, organizational issues that could be worked on? And then we educate on all these things, you know, make sure there's no misunderstandings, and repeat, because adherence is never a one-time-and-you're-done fix. It's coming back to this issue, making sure old problems stay old problems, not current problems, and that there's no new current problems. And so when you put these topologies together and rubber together, this is sort of how it plays out. If someone is unwittingly non-adherent, it's really important to review the regimen and then make sure there's understanding. So providing and reviewing a written treatment plan so that they don't have to count on their memory, because none of us are good at remembering everything that happens in a visit. Have you provided the education? Have you reviewed skills and techniques? Do a tell-me-back, show-me-back of, I just gave you a bunch of information, tell me what you're going to do with this, so that I know I made sure I've told you everything you need to know. Then for rationalized non-adherence, we focus a lot on beliefs. What are the beliefs and concerns about therapies? Am I going to become addicted? I want to save these antibiotics till I really need them, so I'm not going to take them now when my lung function's fine. Develop the discrepancy between what they say their values are. I want to live to have children. I want to be healthy enough to have children, but the behavior doesn't match that, and how we can link values and goals back to therapy. Personalizing adherence and health feedback. So these are your lungs. This is your behavior. This is what's happening for you personally. And then using shared decision making, putting this all together, what path does the patient and family want to go on, and how does that fit with what is medically recommended? Then for erratic adherence, that's really focusing on the barriers. Can we simplify or really tailor the regimen? Can we help shift how patients are doing it because of their life schedules? Really focusing on behavioral strategies, reinforcements there. Those sticker charts are fabulous. Accessing social support. So is there someone in their life who can help them with this, help them set up equipment, clean equipment, just sit with them and be with them to be supportive? And this includes mental health support if there's any depression or anxiety. And then making sure patients are linked into any resources. And then the rubber, again, is the educate and repeat. And this is elicit, provide, elicit. Tell me what you already know. Here's some more information that might be important. Tell me what I just told you so I know you understand. And so, again, the tell me back, show me up. And then following up every clinic, every time. And hopefully, if we all had the resources, we'd be doing this between visits, a quick text. Hey, how's it going? I know you were going to try and do X, Y, Z. I was thinking of you. So tonight, as we're listening to the vignettes, consider what topology might be relevant to this particular person, and then what intervention you want to start with. And I want to point out, it's not uncommon for every patient to have a little bit of everything, but there's usually one that rises to the top, and that one that rises to the top is the place we probably need to start in order to be successful. And with that, I believe we now transition into our first vignette.
I'm Jamie. I'm a senior in high school. I love playing softball. I've played it all my life. I pitch, I play first, and I play second. And I have cystic fibrosis. Not a lot of people know it. I mean, my sister does, but she's my sister. She lives with me. Otherwise, I really don't like to talk about it. I don't want people to look at me differently saying that I'm that sick kid, because I'm not. I'm just like everyone else. I used to do my treatments all the time, back when I was sick, because I had to. But now I feel fine. I don't have to do my treatment 2 times a day with my nebulizer and clean it every time, and do my vest that takes up so much time. I'm not even coughing up any gunk anymore. What's the point of doing it? I don't have time for all of that now. I mean, I have to go to school. I have to go to softball practice right after, which is 6 days a week. And then I have to come home, do hours of homework, and all I want to do is go to sleep, and I just don't have time to do treatments. I don't think it's a big deal when I miss a treatment sometimes. I feel great, so I cough a little bit. I still keep up with everyone else. I take my pills. I mean, I kind of have to. My mom sets them up every day on the table, so she'll know if I don't take them. But, I mean, they're just pills. They're not that hard to take, even when I'm at school. But doing everything else, I mean, sure, if I get sicker, I'll go back and do everything. But I'm feeling great right now. There's no reason that I have to take time out of my day to do it. And you know what else? It really bothers me that every time I do those treatments, it reminds me that I've got cystic fibrosis and that I am that sick kid. I hate that. I just don't want to be known as that. So what's the point of driving myself crazy to fit in all those treatments when I'm feeling so good?
So we'll get back to Jamie's case in a little bit, but how many people in the room know someone like Jamie or care for someone like Jamie? It looks like a vast majority. So I'm Greg Sawicki. I'm a pediatric pulmonologist and the center director at Boston Children's Hospital. And the first part of my talk will be really to talk about individuals like Jamie, who is an adolescent female living with cystic fibrosis, and thinking about why she expresses these challenges around adherence. And what we're going to talk about are the various types of barriers that an adolescent with CF may experience. We'll think about adolescent non-adherence as an individualized problem, taking what Dr. Reichert said as thinking about the individual barriers and problems and challenges that an individual may have related to taking their therapies. And then we'll describe ways to identify adherence barriers. It's very well established that adolescence is a high-risk period in cystic fibrosis. This is data from the U.S. National CF Registry, which shows the average lung function by age based on birth cohort, starting with, in the red line at the bottom, people who were born in the late 80s, moving up to people born in the last decade. And what you can see is, although lung function has improved at every age with every birth cohort, in the box, you can see that the rate of decline of lung function has not changed during the adolescent years, ages 13 to 18, despite any advances in improvements in care. And we can talk a lot about why that may be, but clearly adolescence is a high-risk period from health outcome perspective, and it's also a high-risk period from a developmental perspective. Adolescents with cystic fibrosis and other chronic diseases, for that matter, will have very common attitudes, which are listed here on this slide. For them, cystic fibrosis might be a problem that their parents are taking care of. This is something they were born with, diagnosed when they were very young, and they've always had their parents doing all of their therapies and helping them with them since they were that young. CF can be on the back burner for them. Symptoms could be a nuisance. They minimize symptoms. Adolescents tend to minimize a lot of things, including symptoms. And in fact, they may say that taking medications or completing their treatments does not result in them feeling any better or feeling any different. In fact, they may feel that some of their therapies are making things worse. Jamie in the video talked about how she felt worse sometimes when doing her nebulizers or using her vest. It didn't make her feel well. And then the common thing we often hear is something to that effect of, if I skip my treatments, I don't feel sick. Not doing something for a day or two or three, maybe nothing happens, and gosh, maybe that's a sign that I don't need to take these therapies. But similarly, I think we can't forget that there are people who will think, if I'm perfect with my meds, I shouldn't have any problems. Yet every time they come to clinic, we decided that we need to hospitalize them or do something more in terms of their therapy, despite them taking all these therapies. And so we can't just always assume that it's a reaction around negative or not taking therapies. And as a result, adolescents can develop anger, and that anger can be at the disease, it can be at their caregivers, it can be at their care team. And I think when we think about adherence behaviors, we have to take all of these attitudes in mind. So for all individuals, but particularly for adolescents, what are the factors that influence adherence? Well, there clearly are individual factors: age, gender, literacy, what they understand about their disease and treatments, mental health concerns, behavioral issues, coping styles, and health beliefs, as was previously discussed. But the family is equally important. The structure of the family, the socioeconomic position of the family, health insurance issues, the knowledge that the family has around disease, mental health concerns in family members and caregivers, the way a family copes with chronic disease, what their health beliefs are and their perceptions, the quality of relationships, and their involvement in care. We can't absolve the healthcare system from leading to problems. Access to care, continuity of care, communication between patients, providers, and care teams, biases that providers may have, how frequently individuals are seen in clinic, all these can impact adherence as well. And then at large, the society and community in which an individual lives has a big impact. The school, the neighborhood, their job, their peer support, their social support, and the stigma that they may feel, as Jamie introduced in the video, of not wanting to feel different from other kids that she is going to school with. And so this is why adherence is a challenging problem. It's not just one thing that we can do or think about to address an issue. It can be a multifactorial issue. And there are several challenges, and I will highlight a few challenges that I think are most prominent in adolescents. The first is that of treatment burden or treatment complexity. And I deliberately separated these two because they're not necessarily the same thing. By treatment complexity, I really talk about how complicated it is to do some type of therapy, how long it takes, how many times a day you have to do it, how complicated it is to set up. But the burden is really what an individual perceives about that therapy. So there are many individuals who may only have one treatment to do a day, but may perceive that as very burdensome. And there may be people who have seven treatments that they do a day and perceive none of that as burdensome because they've managed to fit it into their lives. And I think we see a big spectrum in our patients and families around this interface between complexity and burden. And I think it's important for us to disentangle and think about these two concepts separately. It's in part because of the fact that treatment complexity in cystic fibrosis has been increasing. And this is data that was seen in a national database about 10 years ago, looking at 3 years, 2003 to 2005, at a time where there really weren't many new CF medications available to patients. But what you can see is that over the 3 years, regardless of age group, and these are three different bars with three different age groups, the number of medications as defined by a treatment complexity score increased during those 3 years. We at CF care centers are practicing more aggressive early intervention in terms of therapies and recommending many, many more therapies. And that increase in complexity occurred not just for adults and not just for teenagers and not just for sick people and not just for those with better lung function. It was really across the board. And we've done some work to look at the sort of time it takes for patients to complete a day's regimen. And this is one study of adults with cystic fibrosis where simply they were asked how long it takes for them to complete their therapies on a regular basis during one day. And they estimated on average about 2 hours or almost 108 minutes per day for therapies. Most of it are on nebulized care, airway clearance, and exercise. So again, thinking about it in the context of someone like Jamie who has to go to school and softball practice and wants to play with friends and have homework and everything else that she needs to do with her life, 2 hours a day is a lot to ask and a lot to carve out. But it's not just how many therapies we ask our patients to do. There really are challenges in adolescence that I've started to allude to. Adolescents have a desire for greater independence. There's less parental supervision. There's a more erratic lifestyle in terms of sleep, in terms of schedules. There are concerns over social acceptance, and that was clearly seen in the video. There's experimentation and risk-taking, which is a normal developmental process during adolescence, and a sense of invulnerability, which is also a developmentally normal milestone in adolescence. And often adolescents don't have long-term goals or long-term views, and so challenges around daily care and daily therapies can be augmented because of that. Adolescents, when you talk to them about adherence, do identify barriers. They identify barriers similar to what Jamie has stated in the video. Time pressures, lack of time, uncertainty in schedules, forgetfulness, whether it be accidental or purposeful. An awareness of their disease trajectory can sometimes cause some non-adherent behavior and be a barrier. Individuals may recognize the futility in therapy, in adhering to a therapeutic regimen, saying, I'll get sick anyway, why should I bother? Or they may avoid therapies in favor of other activities, because they have a sense that, you know, this is what they want to do, other things. They know that their life is limited. They know they have cystic fibrosis. They've heard all these messages, and they're getting that kind of a picture in their heads. Adolescents can have competing priorities. They need to balance time trade-offs. They want to be normal. They have privacy concerns. They don't want to seem different. And they may not perceive the consequences. And I think this is something that has to be thought about and elucidated in a conversation. But adolescents, when you ask them, actually will also tell you what may facilitate adherence. And these include an understanding and learning of the importance of their therapies, getting that education and accepting responsibility. Sometimes an adolescent may say that they've never actually heard that message from their care team. In fact, their care team may have been spending all of their time educating parents about this, but not talking to the adolescent directly. Adolescents really identify relationships with their CF care team as an important facilitator of adherence behaviors. And they really identify that when the CF team is creative in problem solving, it actually leads to better outcomes. And that goes along with this concept of empowerment. Adolescents want to feel empowered. They want to have some control in what they're doing. They don't want to lose total control. They don't want to have a lack of a safety net. They'll say that they want their parents or caregivers available for help and be around, but they want to also make sure that they're able to exert some independence. They identify self-care skills through repeated practice as an important point in terms of improving adherence behaviors. And I think establishing a structure or a routine is something that all of us can benefit from when it comes to routine activities. And adolescents have identified this as well as a facilitator of adherence. So as we talk through some strategies over the next hour or so of time together, we'll think about ways that we can address some of these challenges. We can think about addressing treatment complexity, thinking about how to make interventions and therapies practical, have them fit into someone's lifestyle, identifies ways to reduce treatment burden. But I think more importantly, we need to think about how to design interventions that are really tailored to the appropriate developmental trajectory of an adolescent and think about their youth-derived goals. And we need to incorporate clinician input, parent input, peer input, support system, and the adolescent's input themselves. And we really do want to foster a system in which we promote adult milestones through early initiation of these behaviors and repeated practice of these skills. So we're going to continue with Jamie's case with the second part of her story.
Hi, Jamie. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good.
I am going to go over your after-visit summary, but I've been hearing great things.
I go to the clinic every third month with my mom. It takes away from going to practice and doing the things I really want to do, but I guess it's something I still need to do.
And I wanted to point out your BMI, because it's really good. So whatever you're doing, keep up the good work. Let's go over your medications a little bit. You have quite a list here.
Now here's the part where she's going to ask me about doing my treatments. Okay, I admit it. I always get nervous. I just hate talking about this.
Your oral medications, your tablets, your enzymes, how are you keeping track of those and keeping up with taking them on a daily basis?
They're usually set out for me breakfast and dinner, and I keep really good track of them. I take them all the time. I'm doing really good with my pills.
I do set them out in the morning for all day for her.
I see that you have some nebulizer treatments. How are you doing with doing this on a daily basis with some airway clearance? That can be a challenge.
I do them most of the time. I try to do them as much as I can.
Did you do them yesterday? I don't remember hearing the best of the nebulizer.
I'm really healthy right now. I'm doing great. I'm so busy doing my sports and my homework. I keep trying to tell them that I'm feeling good. I don't need to do my treatments. I don't have time to do that every day.
And with my schedule, it's hard to keep up with making sure she's doing her treatments.
If I'm feeling good, do I really have to make time to keep doing them?
So how many of us have had this conversation in a clinical setting? Oh, more than the five people that raised their hands, I'm sure. Sometimes I think we wish that there was a little bubble cloud over the family that we were talking to so we could find out what was in their inner workings. And what we don't know here is what the clinician was thinking in her thoughts. And I think bringing that out into the open is really an important step. One of the challenges that comes up with adherence is exactly illustrated by this second vignette, is how are we actually able to measure this? How can we quantify what is actually being done in the home? And so we're going to describe some challenges in measuring adherence to chronic therapies, identify some strategies to measure adherence, and talk a little bit about the advantages and disadvantages of these methodologies. So broadly speaking, we can think about measurement in a couple of different ways. One is self-report, just asking the individual to tell us what they've been taking. That's what was done in the vignette. Another is clinician report, asking the clinician what they think has been taken and what the adherence level has been. We can look at pharmacy records at things like the medication possession ratio or the number of refills that's given or the proportion of days covered. There are different metrics for that. And now there's technology that has electronic monitoring capability. For oral medication, there's something called the MEMS cap. For nebulized devices or airway clearance devices like the Vest, there can be these chips to download and record information. And then there can be other types of monitors on MDIs or other types of equipment. So let's first talk about self and clinician report. That's the easiest, it's the cheapest, it's the thing we can do. And I think there was a very important study that we all should know about that came out of the UK in 2011 where they actually compared both patient report, clinician report, and objective adherence as measured through what's called an iNeb, which is an electronically monitored nebulizer that's available in the UK. And on the left, on the your left, there's the patient report versus objective adherence. And what you can see on the x-axis is the objective adherence rates. On the y-axis, the patient reported adherence rates. A red line would be perfect parity and agreement. And you can see that the vast majority of individuals have high self-reported adherence, but low objective adherence. They're telling you and over-reporting a lot more than what is actually being completed. And there's almost nobody who has, or there is nobody, who has high objective adherence and low self-reports. So if they're saying they're doing everything, they are likely over-reporting. But similarly, if an individual is reporting that they're not completing all their therapies, they're probably more accurate. It's less likely that you under-report such behavior. But I think even more importantly, when we think about provider report versus objective adherence, this circle is someone who has an objective adherence of about 70%, but the clinician has rated their adherence at 10%. So this is an individual who is doing a lot of therapies, but the clinician doesn't believe that they're doing a lot of therapies, and that causes an immediate disconnect in their conversation. Similarly, there are individuals who have almost no objective adherence, 10%, but the clinician believes that their adherence is 70%. This is, again, an individual who would have a conversation and might say, I'm doing all my therapies, but they're not. The clinician believes they're doing all their therapies, and then the individual can leave a clinic visit and say, see, I'm doing just fine. I fooled them. They don't know that I'm not doing anything. And it's really not, again, a source of good communication. And so we really have to move away from self-report and clinician report. This really isn't a good metric when we're really trying to identify truly non-adherent behavior or challenges. So we can think about electronic monitoring. You can think the advantages are there's continuous monitoring, there's long-term, real-time data. It's more objective than self-report. It can identify a large spectrum of issues, including underdosing, delayed dosing, holiday periods, white coat adherence. What I mean there is if someone is coming to clinic and the 3 days before clinic, they do great. You can see that and pick that up. But the disadvantages are that the devices can malfunction, recording may not happen, there could be technology failure or lack of technology in the home if it needs Wi-Fi, for instance. There's a cost to it, and there's privacy concerns. There are many individuals who just don't want every minute and everything in their day monitored, and I think that is a real concern that we have to think about. There have been some studies looking at electronic monitoring, and the first was done again in the UK with the iNeb, looking at adolescent adherence weekdays versus weekends and school time versus vacation time. And they found, it's hard to tell in these graphs, but the average line basically shows that during weekdays, adolescents were more adherent than during weekends, and during school time, they were more adherent than during holiday time. And I think that's an important thing because I think when we think about strategies to improve adherent behavior, it's not an everyday approach either. It can be, you know, dependent on the day, time of day, the day of the week, whether it's a summer vacation or winter vacation or whether it's during school. And more recently, there's been some interesting data on ivacaftor, and we all think that ivacaftor is a medication that everyone's going to be adherent to. It's an oral medication, it's easy, and it is one of these novel CFTR modulators, which has great clinical benefit. So this is data out of Cincinnati Children's Hospital. It was only looking at 12 patients, but it was actually looking at self-report, NPR, and electronic monitors. And in those bars, each representing one patient, the gray bar is self-report. And you can see that pretty much everybody reported 100% adherence to ivacaftor. When it looked at NPR, or prescription refills, they were sort of fluctuation up and down. Some people were filling or overfilling. Some people were not filling their prescriptions at all. And then if you look at the blue, which was the electronic monitor on a cap, it was on a MEMS cap, so they basically, every time the cap was opened to take the medication, it recorded that. The mean adherence was only 61%. So this is for ivacaftor. And what this shows here is that duration between doses and weekly adherence rate, as the study progressed, went down, and the duration went up. So people were taking longer and longer time, 18 hours, 20 hours in between doses instead of twice a day. And these were individuals who knew that they were being monitored, and their adherence rates went down during the study. And so again, suggesting that there's still, this is a behavioral and a human nature challenge that we have to deal with. So pharmacy records, advantages, well again, they identify what medications an individual has obtained, not what was prescribed. And it allows for evaluation of adherence over a longer period of time. But it only measures what an individual has picked up. It doesn't actually tell us anything what's happened in the home once that medication has left the pharmacy. And it's always not always clear what was been prescribed. We as clinicians might sometimes overfill prescriptions. Enzymes is a good example. We might write for 1,000 enzymes for the month, but they only need 600. So over time, they're going to build up a stock, so they're not going to fill a prescription. And they're not really non-adherent. They're just not needing the prescription. Or we might write for a BID med knowing that a copay is higher, and so we want to give people a two-month supply with a one-month prescription. And we may do that, especially in a situation when someone has multiple medications. So it doesn't account for changing treatments over time. Let's think about the adherence typology that Jamie has. And to remember, Dr. Riker presented three typologies, erratic, unwitting, and rationalized. So if you guys on your iPad will let us know what you think is the predominant typology in Jamie's case. So the crowd seems to coalesce around rationalized non-adherent behavior. And when I was reviewing Jamie's case, I certainly felt the same way. She certainly had periods of unwitting and erratic behavior as well. One of the questioners asked us, why is she not using a spacer in the video? And as a pulmonologist, that was the first thing I noticed too. But that could very well be unwitting, non-adherent behavior. Maybe no one's actually ever educated the family that the spacer had to be used. And so I think that is definitely a reality in a real-world situation. But in general, Jamie's behavior, as she explained it, is this rationalized behavior. She says to us, I feel well. Why do I need to take my meds? I'm too busy. I have school. I have softball. Why should I take my meds and take time to do that? She has come up with her own views around why she doesn't need to take her medications. I feel fine despite doing that. Look at me. I'm no sicker than any of my friends. And so what can we do for someone like Jamie? Well, there's a lot of things we could do, and I'm not going to give you the answers in 30 seconds, but I think we need to go back to that rubber mnemonic and think about what we can do. We need to think about her beliefs, develop a mutual understanding of what her goals are in terms of therapy, in terms of school, in terms of her relationships. We need to discuss her concerns about therapy. She's expressed some concerns. We need to understand what they are. We need to think about problem solving around those barriers and around those concerns. We still need to think about education and why these therapies work and make sure she understands why they are important and what the long-term ramifications are. And we need to really engage in shared decision-making. Having a conversation with her, her support team, her parents, her friends, us as a care team, and come to some plan and then review, educate, review, repeat, and consider all these things on an iterative basis. There clearly are a lot of things we could do in addition to this, but this really is the first place to start. But with that, I'm going to turn our attention to a younger child, and we'll go on to our next video. Thank you.
This is Colin. He's almost 5 years old. He has cystic fibrosis and also eosinophilic esophagitis, which means eating has always been a struggle for him. Despite it all, his lung function is still very good.
Colin, it's time for you to come eat your lunch, baby.
5 more minutes, okay?
Colin, you've already had your 5 minutes. You need to come have your lunch now. Let's go. Come on.
Meal times have always been a big problem. His CF clinic has told us he's lacking in good nutrition, and we constantly worry about his slow weight gain and how small he looks compared to other kids his age.
Can I eat real
gummy? Colin's been good at self-selecting out of foods that cause him pain or digestive issues, so we feed him whatever he'll eat. Right now, it's peanuts. He likes them in the shell, and he likes to crack them. He'll sit here forever cracking the shells, but eats very little of them.
Colin, I need you to take some bites of your food, okay? Now, come on, I need you to take one more bite.
We've really tried everything we can think of to get him to eat. Sticker charts, TV time, we've begged, we've pleaded. We've even started explaining that if he doesn't eat, he won't grow up to be a big boy. Or worse, that he'll get sick. Colin's got a whole bag of tricks to avoid eating. He'll play with his food, he'll push it around on his plate. He'll try to get up from the table.
I'm done.
He's too tired. He's too cold. He'll try anything to avoid having to eat. Colin's latest trick is taking a bite or two of food and then telling us he's full or that if he eats any more, he'll be sick.
If I feel like I have to throw up.
The only thing that seems to work now is bribing him.
Colin, I need you to take a sip of milk and then you can have your surprise, okay? Yes, this dinosaur. So take a sip of your milk, please. Stop stalling. Please take a sip of your milk. Thank you. Good job, buddy.
Can I go play?
Now you can go play.
But we can't keep giving Colin new toys at every meal, and he starts school next year. We have to find another way.
Good evening. My name is Mary Marcus. I'm a registered dietitian and clinical nutritionist at the University of Wisconsin Pediatric Pulmonary and Cystic Fibrosis Center in Madison, Wisconsin. And I'm excited to be here tonight to talk to you about something that is near and dear to my heart, and that is feeding kids. Feeding and or food or fluid are fundamental to life, and psychosocial issues surrounding eating and drinking are critical to parenting and family life. And in the case of children like Colin, are even more critical. My learning objectives for tonight are to identify the various types of barriers children with CF may experience, recognize that each child has individualized reasons for non-adherence, and describe ways to identify children's adherence barriers. So, in the case of Colin, he had multiple things going on. He has cystic fibrosis, but he also has eosinophilic esophagitis. So that means he's going to be seeing multiple care providers and maybe multiple care providers on multiple days and different times and visits. And we as care providers also, we may not have the time to provide that continuity of interaction. And we may be providing unclear or recommendations that may be perceived at least as conflicting. Families also may struggle with understanding what it is we've asked them to do, and they may or may not feel comfortable sharing with us the complications of trying to put all these recommendations together into a plan. Also, in terms of health literacy, we can't fall into the trap of assuming that somebody who is, or a family that is higher, more highly educated and perhaps living at a higher socioeconomic status has a higher health literacy than a family at a lower socioeconomic status who maybe doesn't have the same education level and advantages as other families. We've had situations where really the parents weren't the ones providing most of the care. It maybe was a nanny who was doing a lot of the care. The parent was the one coming to clinic. So we really need to find out as well, what is the child and family characteristics, structure, and function, and the caregiving environments that the child may be spending time in where they're receiving care and being fed, maybe school, maybe daycare, maybe different parents' homes if families are divorced. We need to find out all the different environments in which a child may be eating and growing and receiving treatments and therapies. Also, cost and food security play a big role in this younger child population. In the United States, up to 25% of all children live in poverty and hunger, and up to 50% live in low-income homes. What this means is that many of our families that we're caring for may not always have the money to purchase the food, the vitamins, the supplements that we're recommending out of pocket, and still have money for medicine. I've had families tell me they've had to choose between food and medicine, and that is a real concern with this population and with all of our families. Parental stress and depression are also huge factors when any time you've got a child with special needs. In particular, when there's a nutrition issue involved, parental anxiety and guilt can lead to less structured meals and snacks and increased grazing, more intrusive feeding practices, and greater acceptance of mealtime disruptions and negative behaviors, as we saw in the video with Colin. A family's culture and beliefs about food and diet are also important to ascertain, that how necessary they feel the nutritional interventions may be. A family may sort of construct their own view and construct of what adherence is when they're trying to factor all the treatments and the nutritional therapies and so forth in. And because we all have to eat to live, sometimes nutrition isn't viewed as a quote-unquote real treatment. The age of the child can also play a role. Young children don't understand the long-term health implications of being non-adherent. And they also may not be at the age of reason, as with Colin. Food and eating are one thing, though, that young children do know they can control. They can't control very much else in their life, but they can control what they eat, and that gives them power. So what we see oftentimes in nutrition non-adherence in young children with CF is exactly what we saw in the Colin video. Food refusal, stalling. You know, he's eating those peanuts. Why do you think he picked peanuts? It takes a long time to crack a peanut. It takes a long time to eat a bunch of peanuts and then just play with your food, basically. He wanted to get down and leave the table. Distraction. He's trying to distract his mom from needing to eat. Also finding out kind of what's distracting, negotiating, how, you know, could he play for 5 more minutes before he came to the table? Young children often will have a fear of new food, so introducing new foods may take 10 to 20 times before a child will eat them. And then the mixed messages that a child may be perceiving, depending on how many different caregiving environments and how many people are feeding him and what all those family members and care providers may themselves feel about food and nutrition. And then, of course, as I talked about, the autonomy and power of no. And the fact that Colin was being rewarded for his behavior just further fueled his negative behaviors. And in fact, nutrition non-adherence in young children is twice as likely in kids with CF than not CF. So how do we find out what the adherence barriers might be for a young child with CF? We don't have the opportunity to to call up the grocery store and find out when they last refilled their groceries. We don't have video cameras in people's homes seeing what's happening at mealtime like we did with Colin. So we have to sort of do an interview. It's a lot of patient self-report, which we know is not always very accurate. So we need to ask the question in lots of different ways and lots of different times over to try to get that picture in your inner minds of what's going on. So asking who's responsible for meals, what's eaten at mealtime, what happens when the meal or snack is not eaten or the food is refused, what distractions might be present for both the child and the parent or caregiver, phone, tablet, TV, video games, other toys, siblings, other people around the table that may be distracting. I've had families tell me that they basically stopped talking at dinner time because it was so important for the child with CF to eat that it totally changed the sort of landscape of what mealtime looked like. I mean, when you guys are all eating, you hear lots of like discussion and chatter and eating and communication. You know, eating is so much more than just fueling yourself. There's such a social component to it. So to have to take that away in order to get a child to eat is pretty extreme. Asking how long meals and snacks take is also an important thing to know. Problem behaviors are more likely to show up in the second half of the meal, and also the number of bites per minute is inversely correlated with the length of the meal. In other words, the longer you sit there doesn't necessarily mean the more food that's going to be consumed. Finding out how enzymes, vitamins, and supplements are given and how often they're missed and what happens when they're missed, and then also asking who's responsible for administering them. You'd be surprised at how young of a child sometimes is responsible for taking their own enzymes and supplements at mealtimes. And also to sort of go along with this, also, of course, finding out, does the family have any concerns about meals or snacks? Do they feel the meal and snack time are going all right or not? And what is typical meal and snack time look like? How much is eaten at one time? And then who decides what to eat and who decides how much is enough? Using the rubber mnemonic again, I sort of modified it slightly in terms of applying it to nutrition. So we'd ask what the family and child say they're doing, and what's their understanding of why, how, and what they're doing for their nutrition care plan specifically. What beliefs do they maybe have about nutrition? What worries or concerns do they have? And what are the family's goals and values? I can't tell you how many times I've heard, "Oh, but I was so skinny when I was little." Are there any personal, financial, social, or organization system barriers? And by that, what we're really getting at is sort of the food security issue that I alluded to earlier. And do any of the family's beliefs or goals conflict with any cultural or religious concerns that may be present? And then, of course, clarifying the treatment plan, correcting misunderstandings, and answering questions. And then, of course, just the repeating, because we know it takes multiple times of going over the plan.
How are you doing today? Hi, Colin. So bribing him has become the only thing we can do to get him to eat. Maybe it's a mistake because we can't afford to buy him new toys for every meal, but nothing else we've tried works. I really don't know what else to do.
We're concerned that he's really at a higher risk nutritionally, so we want to spend a little bit of time talking about that.
I know. This is something we worry about constantly, and we've tried everything it feels like, and we fight this battle 3 times a day, every day, trying to get him to eat, and we just don't seem to be making any progress.
How about Dad? Is he involved at all at mealtime? Maybe that father-son bond would help. Is he in the picture?
Yeah, Dad's involved, and we really see this as a team effort. We're in this together to really try to get him to eat, and we've tried everything. This is a daily struggle. 3 meals a day, every day, and it's very frustrating.
Many times we end up letting him not eat so we can enjoy our meal. We know it's not right, but it's really hard on our family.
But I think we are really, at this point now, really concerned that he's at a very high risk and we may have to consider some other option.
Well, what else can we do?
So kind of following along the same pattern of the Jamie case review, now with the Colin case review, I'm going to ask you what you think the dominant typology is. I agree there were all three of those typologies present. When I looked at it, I thought there was more rationalized than unwitting and erratic, but certainly all three were present. Bearing that in mind, and also keeping in mind the new Cystic Fibrosis Foundation preschool care guidelines that will be coming out later, I think fairly soon, I would, again, looking at what are the family's goals and making sure that the family's goals are on board and that we're in agreement on that, and discuss beliefs and concerns about nutrition that the family may have. I'd also provide some education on nutritional behavior therapy, sort of along the lines of the work that Scott Powers has done, and why that's really necessary and how rewarding Colin's eating behaviors with attention and toys is just making the situation worse, provided, of course, with the illicit approach. And then doing some shared decision-making, looking at, again, making sure that there's consistency with parenting and consistency with the other providers who may be in the picture. And then I would probably also begin to plant some seeds for potentially a future G-tube if all other methods of working at improving his nutritional status were not working. And it's good to sort of plant those seeds early, and really just sort of, I try to present it as a, this is just another tool that we have that some families may choose to go down so that they can really be thinking about it and it can be a shared positive decision for the family, and that they don't feel like they have no choice and that there's, that they just have to do it.
My name is Amy. I'll be 30 years old next month, and I've got cystic fibrosis. And lately, it's been really hard. Maybe in some ways I was lucky. I didn't really get a lot of symptoms until I was in college. So when I was growing up, I could pretty much be a normal kid. None of my friends had to know that I had CF. I still don't want anyone to know. But now, I'm getting a lot of symptoms that I never had as a kid, so it's getting tough to hide. I've had a really hard time holding down a job because of how often I get sick and have to go to the hospital. Hey, Mr. Ravel, that's Amy. Yeah, no, listen, I'm really sorry, but I'm not going to be able to make it in again today. No, I understand, but yeah, I'm just really still feeling sick. All right, I'm sorry. Thank you. I've got a few close friends, but I always feel different and like I'm an outsider, left out of things. They're all in relationships, falling in love. They're all going to get married, have kids, start a life with someone.
Beautiful.
But I'm never going to have that. I'm always going to be alone.
If you would want to help me plan the engagement party.
Yeah, sure. No, yeah. How's anyone going to love me or accept me when I have cystic fibrosis? I'm always sick or in the hospital. I've been to a few CF centers. They're always nagging at me, Amy, do this. Amy, you aren't doing that. Like the vest. Cough up gunk for half an hour while getting pounded on. How's that even supposed to help? It's just embarrassing and gross. I moved to Baltimore last month to take care of my aunt. But most of the time, it's hard enough just taking care of myself. I honestly don't believe that there's anything that's going to help me.
Alrighty, so such as adult providers, how typical is Amy of experiences you guys have, where there's just not a lot of hope and not really knowing where to start? So my goal for tonight is to talk about the adult challenges, so things that are unique to adults. So Greg talked a lot about beliefs and all those things, and they really still apply with adults, but there are some specific challenges that really come up once individuals move into adulthood. So our goals are to look at the various types of barriers, the individualized reasons, and ways to identify those barriers specific for adults. Okay, so in qualitative interviews with adults, they can identify many things that are barriers as well as things that are helpful. And this is really important to get perspective of what's challenging and how we can help. And so much as with teenagers, the treatment burden, social demands, those are really high up on things that get in the way of doing therapies. But once they become adults, work demands come in as well. And forgetting, absence of perceived benefit, so this medication is doing nothing for me, I'm just too darn tired to do anything, and feeling some stigma or embarrassment. Again, very similar to teenagers, but also still very common adults. But things that help, so coming to see us clinics. Now, sometimes this is because I'm scared of what you're going to tell me, so again, I do better right before, so maybe I get my lungs cleaned out enough that that number won't be so scary. Or I found the visit really motivating and supportive, and so that's really helped me get re-energized to keep doing therapies. Support, you know, family members, sitting with them, helping them out is really key and helping provide reminders when they feel better. So sometimes adults, because they're already so sick, they're more likely to feel better once they do therapies. They can tell when I've missed treatments for a week, I'm coughing more, I'm more congested, I don't have energy. And then if I can kind of get the habit back, I start to feel a little better, and that can be very reinforcing. You know, burden again, how easy is it for me to do this? How easy is it for me to fit this into my life? And can I make it a habit and a routine? And that's really challenging, so how do you do that? And distraction and rewards, is there something I can do while I'm doing my therapies to keep me entertained? We know with the teenager, when she was on her phone, and that may or may not be a good thing, if it affects technique, but at least gets them doing therapies. And the same with adults. Many folks will say, you know, the only time I let myself go on social media is when I'm doing therapies. That way, at least I feel like I'm doing something, I'm distracted, and it's a bit of a reward. And some adults will say, I do my therapies because I'd feel too guilty if I didn't. So that's a challenge. Health beliefs are really important across all age groups, but particularly in adults, because it's ultimately on them. So a child might not feel it's important to do it, but my mom does, and so it happens. But once you're an adult and you're really on your own and making these decisions, understanding how, if the patient thinks it's important, if there's any inkling of why bother, then that's probably a red flag. And so all these are on 1 to 10 scales, and it's really just saying, on a 1 to 10 scale, how important do you think it is to do your therapies every day? On a 1 to 10 scale, how motivated are you to do your therapies every day? And then for self-efficacy, it's a series of questions. When faced with certain challenges, you have work to do, you want to go out with your friends, you're feeling tired, how confident are you that despite those challenges, you can get your therapies done? And in each and every case, you can see here that those who rate importance, motivation, and self-efficacy higher are also those who have higher adherence. So these are very just really easy things that folks can integrate into clinical practice to get a good sense of where we need to start. Now, unique to adults is employment. They're no longer in school. They don't get any accommodations. They're in the workforce. And so the good news is most adults with CF do find jobs and are independent from their parents, and that's a fabulous thing. But CF really does impact adherence. Amy was having a hard time keeping down a job because I have to keep calling off because I'm sick. And so CF can affect the career that you choose. Sometimes you have to work part-time or stop working completely. Sometimes it's because you're too sick, but sometimes it's just I'm prioritizing doing my therapy, so therefore I'm going to work part-time or not work at all so that I can fit this in. And many adults do talk about either actual or fear of workplace discrimination, that because I'm out so often, I'm not going to get put on that account or have that opportunity because my boss is worried that I won't be there when it's time for the big meeting or the big project or the deadline. So I don't get opportunities. Or I can't go because they know I can't travel, so I won't get a promotion to a job that has more travel. And so they feel that sometimes it really is a hindrance. And very few adults are comfortable doing therapies at work. And for most therapies, it's not an issue. You do it before you go to work. You do it when you come home from work. But there are things, enzymes, that middle dose of a three times a day treatment, those are all things that might have to happen at work to really be adherent. But you don't want to do it. You don't want to be the person with CF, the sick person. You want to be known as who you are and the type of worker you are. And again, just incredibly stressful balancing employment and CF care. There's a lot of unique social aspects as well once you're in adulthood. So when you're a child, your parent, you know, is there. They're, when you're feeling sick, they're there to take care of you. Once you get married, your spouse, hopefully if you have a good spouse, is there to take care of you. And take care of you not just when you're sick, but just day in, day out. Setting up the equipment, reminding you to do things, sitting with you, empathizing with how hard this is, doing the grocery shopping so you can get therapies done, you know, all those sorts of things. But when you're a young adult and so you're in that transition period, you may be living alone or living with roommates. And, I mean, I had some fabulous roommates, but I don't know how many would help me with IV therapies if I needed help or would run to the grocery store for me or help take care of me when I don't feel well or perhaps even notice if I'm not feeling well on a particular day. And so it's really a very vulnerable time where you lose some of the social support. And again, because you're sick and you have a lot of therapies to do, social functioning goes down, and it's more the quality of life of social functioning, not that they don't have social skills anymore. But that the quality of life goes down in terms of their social life, and therefore satisfaction with life goes down as well, that I just feel like all I do all day is take care of my CF, and am I taking care of my CF to live or living to just take care of my CF? And really a desire to be normal. I mean, we all want to be normal. Some of us do a little better than others. But, you know, I want to get married. I want to have kids. I want to advance my education. But I don't know if I can or will. And it makes it very hard to plan. And it can leave individuals feeling hopeless and questioning and wondering and feeling sometimes alone and just very different. And that all can then just snowball and build up some resentment to CF and then not wanting to do therapies just to avoid. And one way this plays out is in disclosure. So when you're a kid, your parent sometimes has told, like, everybody, and you have no control. Everybody at school seems to know, et cetera. But as you become an adult, you have more control over this. This is a really interesting study because they asked, who have you told? And it goes from people who are very close to you, so relatives, all the way over to just acquaintances. And, you know, there's close friends, people you're dating, your bosses, supervisors, teachers, coworkers, neighbors, et cetera. And the dark blue bars are all of them. I've told all of them. They all know. And the very light blue bar is none of them. And what you can see is even with relatives, there's about 15% of people who say not even all my relatives know I have CF. And as you move towards, again, remember I said in the 20s, you're with roommates, et cetera. So, you know, maybe my close friends know, but coworkers and neighbors don't. And so if I live by myself and I'm sick, who's going to notice? Because they don't even know I have CF. They don't know what's wrong. So this is a challenge. And so that's just who you tell. Then we've done some research, and it's going to be presented at a symposium tomorrow afternoon. So if you're around in the afternoon, about relationships and CF. And we've shown that if you ask people how comfortable are you talking about CF with these different groups and how comfortable are you doing therapies in front of them, people who are more comfortable have higher social support and higher self-efficacy. And those things then are linked to adherence. So really thinking about disclosure and who have they told? How can we help them be more comfortable talking about CF? How can we help anticipate what challenges they might face by telling individuals is really important. As I said, hopelessness comes along, but there's something called fatalism. And Amy had a bit of the fatalism of, am I ever going to get married? Who would ever want to marry me? And around adherence, that could manifest itself as, what's the point? What will be. My life is in, God's hands, fate's hands, any higher power. It's not in my control. So what's going to be, what's going to be, so why bother doing my therapies? Or even if I do my therapies, I'm not going to get any better. And this data really shows that the higher fatalism scores are associated with lower adherence. So when you hear these kind of statements of what's the point, hopelessness, helplessness, you really do need to start thinking, perhaps this is also going to affect their adherence. Now we're going to see Amy with her care provider.
So welcome to our clinic, Amy.
Thanks.
When was the last time that you were seen in your old clinic?
My aunt made me go to the CF Center here in Baltimore, and I hate these first-time visits. Same stupid questions all over again. Same stupid lists of things for me to do. You need to be adherent, Amy. You need to be compliant. Really? Like any of that's going to make a difference?
I'm a little bit concerned today. It looks like your PFTs have worsened since your last clinic visit at your old center. Now, your old center put you on Estrianam for 4 weeks. Have you been able to take that therapy?
I've tried that. It does not work for me. It doesn't do anything. I told them this, too. It doesn't do anything for me. I tried those inhaled antibiotics once. Spent all that time learning how to set it all up, used it for about 2 minutes, then my throat started burning, and I began coughing like crazy. Yeah, that's really helpful. It makes me feel a lot better.
Estrianam is an important inhaled antibiotic, and it's going to treat the bacteria that you have in your lungs. Typically, we want you doing it for 4 weeks. Is that a commitment that you can make?
honestly, I don't think so. Like I said, it takes up all my time. How about 2 weeks? Can I try it for 2 weeks and see how I do?
No. Unfortunately, we need for you to do the prescribed therapy, which is a 4-week course. So we want to be on your side and get your lung function up, and that's how we know to do that.
None of it helps. My lung function. She just doesn't get it. It's hard enough just getting through the day. How am I going to do more treatments, get to work on time, or have a social life? Will doing one more medication really make a difference? Who wants to live that way? This stuff takes up my whole life. All I do is spend time on nebulizers and vests and airway clearance, and then I end up in the hospital. I'd rather at least just have somewhat of a life until I die rather than spend my whole time doing stuff that doesn't make any difference.
Again, probably some sentiments that we've heard from patients that we see. So as we've done before, let's do our question of, what do you perceive as the dominant topology for Amy? Unwitting, erratic, or rationalized? Right, so rationalized. That is also how I saw it. But again, throughout, there's many aspects that we want to do. And you see that all three of us picked rationalized. And I think that's interesting as we're coming up with our cases. Because I think what we typically do as clinicians is trying to provide a lot of education. If they just know what they need to do, they'll do it. So that unwitting. But when we think about these topologies, we say, maybe that's not the most predominant thing. So we need to think about what should we be doing first. And with Amy, I think it's really important. It's her first clinic visit with this care provider, and already she's sort of ready to go to battle. And there's eye rolling. It's going to be really important to start that partnership. So I personally would start a lot not even talking about CF. Who are you? What do you like to do? You came to Baltimore. Have you made some friends? So that you really get to know, and so that there's a sense that there's a partnership and that she's understood. Because I think right now she really feels like nobody gets me. They just want to tell me what to do. They all say the same thing. They tell the same thing to everybody. What's the point? And so that's really where I think she needs to be. We probably don't need to start with education about why an antibiotic is so important. Not that you might not need to hear that, but it's probably not the place to start. So I would start with discrepancies. What are her beliefs and concerns about therapies? It sounds like she might have a lot of negative experiences with trying therapies, and so there might be some concerns about starting again. And only after I really understand her beliefs and her perceptions, then I'm going to start with education, because then I can pinpoint there's places where she's accurate and places where she might have some misperceptions. And it's got to be provided with empathy. It can't be, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. This is really going to work for you. It has to be really, I understand it's challenging. This doesn't work for everybody, but this is the best way we know to help you. And so how can we work together to get this done? And I think for Amy, shared decision-making is really going to be key. Again, she just feels like people are piling stuff on her. And once she feels like I've made that decision, I'm choosing to do this, it becomes a lot easier to do that. So think about it. We're all oppositional 2-year-olds, even if we're 30 years old. No one wants to be told what to do. But gosh, if it was my idea, then it's brilliant. So we need to try and engage our families into thinking, not tricking them. I don't want it to sound like we're trying to trick them into wanting to do it, but that we've come to this agreement and that is what they do want to do because it has been developed with them and for them and tailored. And for Amy, I'm a little bit concerned about some depression. She has a lot of hopelessness statements, right? All my friends are getting married. What's the point? Why do these therapies? I'm going to die anyway. So I would really want to screen her for depression and make some referrals for counseling and therapy will be important. And if she says, I'm willing to try this antibiotic, my job isn't done, because she also says, how do I fit this all in? So I think it's not just convincing patients to do therapies, but then really sitting with them and saying, well, now, okay, it's great you want to do this. Let's talk about what your life looks like and how can we make this the least intrusive possible. And what could we adjust? What could we combine? What could we maybe stop while we're doing this to try and really make it manageable and most likely to be successful? Because we don't want Amy to feel like she's failed again, because she might just move on to another care team and it's not helpful to just keep moving care team to care team and not having any continuity. So that's all I want to say about Amy. So our next section is going to be a little more interactive. We're going to talk about engaging the patient and family and trying to create a dialogue, even in this large group setting where we can't really see you, through the tablet. So we're going to pose some questions to you, and you guys are going to use the Ask a Question function to give your best practices and your help, because I think it's fine and dandy for me to sit here and give you what I think might work, but you all are experts as well and have come up with lots of fabulous things, and we need to start sharing those ideas. So we're going to have a conversation here as well, and we're going to highlight some of the most common themes, etc. After that, we're going to have a Q&A and do the post-test, and then we do have a video kind of saying kind of where all our vignettes ended up. So the learning objectives for this section is to talk about patient and family-centered communication, recognize when we need additional supports beyond what the capacity of a care team in the clinic setting can do, describe characteristics of difficult conversations, and think about tips that can promote positive conversations between patients and families and care teams. So our first discussion point is to talk about what makes it difficult to have conversations about adherence with their patients and families. So again, use the Ask a Question tab, and just, it doesn't have to be a big paragraph, because I know that's a lot to type, but some phrases about what makes it difficult to have that conversation. All right, so time is like the number one. There's just not enough time in clinic. And that is a problem we all have. There's not enough time, there's not enough staff. And so how do you guys work on it in your clinics to try and build that time to establish relationships and come up with solutions?
You want me to go ahead? Okay. Well, I think that it's actually a really challenging thing, and it looks like in our audience, time is really coming up that much. I think part of the challenge is the number of encounters that you have with an individual or family in terms of how often you see them and how you develop that relationship. Because I think fundamentally, if you have a strong relationship with a family, time should be a less of an issue. And that relationship can be built over a period of visits. And I think if we try as a care team to accomplish everything in one visit, it's never a recipe for success because we're never going to have the time to do all this, despite our best intentions. And so sometimes it's bringing someone in more frequently, establishing contact in between visits. You know, it doesn't have to be in the clinic. It can be over phone calls. It can be over some type of communication. I think we as a community are not always as creative as we could be in doing that.
I see a lot of things in here as well about emotions and guilt and families feeling and team members just feeling uncomfortable talking about these issues with care providers and feeling like we're placing blame or judging the patients. Mm-hmm. And what I try to do is I want them to be as honest as possible, and there's no right or wrong answer. That's why, you know, I don't ask a patient, are you taking your vitamins? I say, how often are you missing your vitamins? So trying to, like, set the stage of that expectation is that I know that I don't take my medicine and vitamins and stuff every day. I don't expect anybody to. So just trying to lay that foundation and building the rapport, as Kristen was saying earlier, and finding out what's going on with them, what's new, trying to figure out what's motivating them and what maybe else is going on that's taking their time and priorities.
I think defensiveness came up a lot, and one of the greatest things I learned through my training in motivational interviewing is when you're feeling that defensiveness, that resistance, it probably means you've pushed a little too far, that you're asking for something they're not ready for. It's not that they don't necessarily want to have the conversation, but perhaps they're not ready to trust you to have that conversation with them. So how can we build that trust and rapport? And I think that's time. I think it's changing your mindset again, as Mary said, of it's okay to be non-adherent. We all are. I think maybe not even using the word adherence, you know, is sometimes, I think that's just the ugly word in the room. And so how do you get it in? How can I be helpful? What can I do now to be helpful to you is a good way to start. Because if you're saying, I want to help you, what can I do? That puts the patient in control. And it puts them in the driver's seat so they really can start thinking of the solutions. Because ultimately, what I've found is once you open the conversation up to possibilities, patients or families are actually usually come up with a better solution than I have. So really trying to engage and have that conversation. What can I do? What have you tried? What hasn't worked? So that we don't go down that path.
I want to make just a comment. Is that I noticed that there's some folks who are talking about what disciplines should do this. I was wondering if you're in clinics, again, if you have a specific discipline, or do you spread that evenly?
I think that's a great question, and it's one that is important to address as a care team, because if you do rely on one discipline, I think that can sometimes paint the picture to the family that, well, when they're going to talk to the social worker or the nutritionist or the nurse or the doctor, they're going to be getting one message, and they're going to be getting another message from the other person, another message, and then they won't know who to believe or who to talk to, or they'll talk to the person who they feel, quote-unquote, partners with them, even if they're just sort of listening, not listening, and just sort of going through their emotions, and they don't want to interact with the people who actually challenge them or ask the complicated questions. So I think I think a lot of us try this already, but I think really making a focus on a unified understanding and a unified message. And I think there have been some comments here about, well, we don't want to over-ask the same question so the family feels like they're repeating themselves. But I think there is some power in repetition and power in knowing that there's a community of clinicians that are all on the same page when it comes to that. And especially true for families, getting the parents and the adolescents to agree and discuss in a room, you know, having that big discussion, I think, is quite critical as well.
Someone brought up a really important point here of open-ended questions. And I'm doing some audio tape doctor-patient visits in a different chronic illness, and we transcribe them, and it's fascinating how rare healthcare providers ask an open-ended question, and even when they do, they ruin it by then going, making it a multiple choice question. And so it's going to be really important to ask that open-ended question. And the reason we jump right into the multiple choice is the patient doesn't answer right away. But we need to remember that they're hearing this question and they're actually thinking about their answer. And so we need to pause and maybe count to five and give them time to answer. Because I think they'll feel more heard and then more participatory, and that we really care about what they're talking about. So I think we'll move on to the next question. So our next question is, so now knowing that this is a difficult conversation, how can we promote that positive question, that conversation, sorry, about adherence and self-care with patients and families, and particularly in a collaborative way? So we've come up with a few things, but we'd like to hear your ideas as well.
I think some people have already started answering this question sort of with, they're very related, and listening, acknowledging, opening the door, all those kind of comments are coming through here, and I think it's absolutely true that what Kristen said about not just open-ended questions, but listening to the responses and not, I think we all have a tendency sometimes to say, if we don't get the answer we want or we really are driving an agenda, that we are going to start by saying an open-ended question where we think it's an open-ended question, but we actually don't listen to the answer, but we pride ourselves on saying we've asked something open-ended. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a challenge in the healthcare system right now, is especially for physicians, but for the whole care team, about all the things that we need to do at every visit. Review medication lists, review allergies, ask if the patient's in pain, see if they're smoking, fill out checklists, document on a chart everything in front of a computer and not actually look at the patient.
I was just going to say the same thing. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, you've got your list in your mind of everything you've got to, like, get through, and they give you an answer that then takes you, whoop, way over here, and you're like, oh, my God, I got to get back over here, and how can I get back over here? Mm-hmm. And really needing to take that time to let that happen and let that conversation go in that other direction, because you may actually get much better answers and come to a better care plan and better outcomes in the end by allowing that.
And knowing that the agenda you walked into the room might not be the conversation that needs to be had at that point in time, and being flexible and ready to go, like you're saying.
Exactly. Yep.
And I think, you know, Greg makes a great point of, you know, we're sitting and filling out the computer. We're completely missing body language then. And I think all three of our vignettes had some pretty clear body language in our clinic scenarios, because it's there if you see it. You know, it's pretty easy to tell when someone's engaged and when someone who's completely disengaged, and what can we do to, you know, keep that focus. Is we need to make eye contact if we want them to make eye contact with us. You know, those little things of, we need to have open body language, look like we're settling in for a good conversation, not looking like we're trying to rush out the door because we're busy, because us looking like we need to rush out the door says, I don't want to have a conversation with you. And so we need to really try and open that up.
Just make a comment. I know we've heard from a lot of teens and patients and families who talk about sometimes how the clinic is set up, and sometimes you have to have your back to folks. I love the vignettes. You could look across from each other. But sometimes you might have your computer situated in a clinic room where you might have your back to it, or you're sort of just not facing and making in that eye contact. So sometimes just the context of the environment you have to kind of take into account as well.
So I think the concept of relationships has come up a lot here too. It's really about developing that relationship. It's not just the one-time encounter. It's the multiple encounters. And we do that already as a system, but I think we can probably try to do that even more, particularly when it comes to these type of issues.
And I think when it comes to time, you know, if someone had a decrease in their lung function or increase of symptoms, we would bring them back sooner. And I think if they're having challenges with fitting in treatments, we should bring them back sooner. I mean, we don't want to burden them by having lots of visits, but it also points to how important it is. And if we can't bring them back, those follow-up contacts are really key. And it doesn't necessarily have to be long or lengthy, but thinking about you, wondering how it's going. We talked about you were going to try and do X. How is it going? And it doesn't necessarily have to be a lot, but you can't underestimate how powerful that is, that someone was thinking about me when I was not face-to-face with them. And therefore, I'm important to them, but what I'm going through is important to them as well. And so trying to be creative about different ways to stay in contact between clinic visits is going to be really key. Okay, so with many of these cases, we talked about possibly needing more support. So, you know, in Colin's case, maybe he needed behavioral therapies for nutrition. The parents needed some parent training. Clearly that is not being done in a clinic setting. Amy might need some depression counseling. That's not happening in clinic visit. So how no, I forgot what the question was. I lost the question. What do you do when you know that there needs to be referrals? That it's beyond what you guys can handle. What can be done? So we're getting a lot of refers, but who do you tend to refer to? And we can either say like nutrition, who I refer to, or mental health issues, who I refer to, just so we have a sense. Because I find that's some of the biggest challenges is finding the right folks to refer to. I know a lot, you know, I'm trained as a psychologist, and a lot of psychologists are not necessarily knowledgeable about CF, and so they don't really understand, A, the burden. They don't understand the regimen. Some of them can't fathom that you should eat high fat, high salt, and so they might give information counter.
Right.
You know, they look at the life expectancy and almost get giddy to talk about death and dying issues when that's not really what the issue is.
I like the comment here that somebody made about refer with patient buy-in, and I think that is key in order for it to be successful, really looking at the patient as an equal member of the care team, of their care team, really.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I envision it as the patient in the middle, like a bullseye, patient's in the middle, and then all the rest of us are like little like satellites all like out around. But really it's the patient and the family who need to be driving the show, and really remembering that and keeping that at the forefront of everything is really, I think, what's going to help drive things forward.
But I also think that the question was sort of loaded in the where do you ask for help kind of domain. But I think even if we try to promote referrals, if we have a referral that works, if we have a system that works, which is sometimes a challenge, as you mentioned, even in that situation, even if there's buy-in from the family, we can't absolve ourselves as a care team from moving and continuing that relationship building.
Absolutely.
Despite that.
Absolutely.
Because we can't just say, oh, well, we can't handle it. We're going to find a referral out, and I hope that they can handle it because it's not our issue anymore.
Right.
I think that can be a tendency sometimes for care teams to try to sort of move their responsibility and shift it. And so I think that these comments about making sure the family and the individuals are buying into it as well is quite important.
I think that is really, the buy-in is really important. And I think as soon as you bring up the word psychology, people say, I'm not nuts. And so I always found, you know, I would walk into the room and I couldn't even start the consult or something because it'd be, I'm not crazy. And I'd have to be like, yeah, well, I don't work with crazy people. I work with people who have, you know, problems in life and could use somebody to talk to and strategize how to move forward. So I'm like, I don't work with the super crazy people. Those are just for psychiatrists. I work with normal people who just need some help talking some stuff through. Just to try and like take away some of that stigma around needing more help. It is always interesting that, well, it's challenging to get them to any, you know, as other specialists because it's just more time, more burden,
right.
And why do I have to take this on? But I think mental health particularly is challenging to get folks to, and behavioral health, and recognizing that behavioral health is more than just depression, anxiety, but it's also problems swallowing pills, problems with you know, getting swabs or giving, you know, sputum samples, or you know, there are things that behaviors can do to help with those things.
And even looking for referrals outside of the healthcare system. I mean, somebody in here is commenting about, you know, looking to like faith-based resources and other sort of community resources, especially if your center serves a more rural community where it may not be reasonable to get those kind of mental health services in particular on a regular basis, to find somebody local and at the community level.
And one person brought up a very important part. We're talking about referring to professionals, but there's also how do we engage families and neighbors, friends, other supports, you know, that are not necessarily trained but can be very helpful. So it's beyond what I can do here in the room, but is that, do you have, you know, can grandma get more involved? Can as an adult, you know, can your parent be a little more helpful? And I think that's really key because those are more sustainable.
And one more referral that people have mentioned here is peers. And I think mm-hmm. some peer-to-peer, even though we have infection control limitations, like utilizing some technologies and other ways. And I know that the CFF is working on that. And I know local centers have peer programs that they've developed. And I think that can be quite powerful for certain individuals as well.
Yeah, and the comment about getting community and neighbors and so forth involved, you know, there are websites like Lots of Helping Hands that we have some CF families that utilize that where the mother has sort of initiated it and families can come in or neighbors can come in and help just with laundry or just doing, you know, dishes and whatever. And so that's just a way to really help support that family in other ways.
So now we're going to transition throughout the evening. You guys have been submitting some questions and answers, so we're going to go to those now.
One of the questions was, I think, a really important one when it comes to adolescents. Understanding adolescent cognitive development, what level of non-adherence should we as healthcare professionals actually accept? Where is there a balance between pushing for treatments and promoting achievement of normal development and accepting some level of non-adherence? And I think that's a really excellent question and also one that I think we need to grapple with because there may be a point at which we do accept some level of non-adherence. And whether we term it non-adherence or just a level of a treatment plan that may not be exactly what we as a clinician wanted. And I think the language that we use with an individual, particularly an adolescent and their families, is critical there because it is really part of that shared decision-making and behavioral strategies and planning to say, you know, what works for you, what are your barriers, let's make a plan. And then that may build up to an agreement that works on both ends. So I think we can accept some levels of non-adherence as long as we understand the context in which these are happening.
And I think it has to be an informed non-adherence that everybody understands the pro and con of doing more or doing less. And I'm a data geek, so I always want more data showing me the curve of how much is enough. For me, how much do I have to take to get the benefit? And some patients and families, they do this themselves. They say, this is enough, and I don't want to do more. And as long as that's an informed decision that I'm doing the trade-off of I'd like to trade a little bit of I'll be a little symptomatic to not have to do this much more therapy so that I can go out with my friends at night or I can get to my children's events, then that is a thought-out decision that we have to agree and work with and move forward with that I think is really key.
So another question was raised about how about CF patient support groups. I think that's a good question, and we sort of mm-hmm. started alluding to that. And Cindy, I'll turn it to you to see sort of maybe nationally, are there efforts around those kind of things?
Yeah, I think you were alluding to it, Greg, that we are just starting a peer mentoring pilot that we're going to be offering across several centers just to see, you know, how well it goes. And using video technology and online, other types of channels, communication channels, that we can connect adults with their mentors. So we'll be having a list of mentors who, you know, folks who have probably been screened by your care centers, just so that we make sure that folks are, you know, okay for the mentoring. But we want to also stay out of the medical realm. We just want to make sure that it's about living with CF. And we'll have a coordinator at the foundation on that. So very much definitely something we have to start promoting. We hear that from folks as well. So.
I think so. There's something to think about. So I think there are a lot of people that are very interested in some peer mentoring, some peer support. There's also a not small group who have zero interest in it at all because they've already known someone who's died of CF. They don't want to watch somebody else get sicker who's been doing everything and they're not doing. So sometimes it can invoke some guilt. And so it has to be, I think, fairly well moderated to make sure that it stays as positive as possible and doesn't just become, you know, I think when you have elderly folks who are not sick, you know, soon everybody's dying. You see all your friends at the funeral because look who died now. You don't want it to become that it's sad and depressing and not the support that we want it to be. So it has to be well thought out and very positive. And I think short term is probably good. And then if they want to build longer term relationships outside of the structure, it probably will then be up to individuals to create those relationships.
Yeah, I'll just make one last comment. That was actually just built by adults with CF parents, as well as care providers were came together, psychologists, so that we definitely did put all those elements in because we know that that's really very, very critical to those success of those programs, no harm comes.
I think there's another good question about focusing more on wellness rather than preventing deterioration. I think that's really key is how do we stay healthy? Making, you know, all people need to work to stay healthy, and so we normalize it. Everybody has to get exercise. Everybody has to eat healthy. Yours has a slightly different bend to how that is, but everybody needs to do something to stay healthy. And so when you put that swing on it, it's much more positive. I think folks who are comfortable using exercise for airway clearance versus a vest, I've heard lots of people say, I'd rather run on the treadmill because healthy people run on the treadmill. Sick people do vest. And so that's how they've conceptualized it. So as long as the care team is willing to partner with that, half hour on a treadmill a day, I'm impressed. So I did just want to remind everyone that the group that helped us create this CME course also does some e-cystic fibrosis review. These are review experts provide reviews of current topics and do podcasts that you may be interested in.
When I was younger, I wanted nothing to do with my CF. I didn't want to know that I had CF. I didn't want other people to know. So I thought, oh, if I didn't do my treatments, didn't take my pills, I don't have it. Because I didn't do my treatments regularly, didn't take the pills I was supposed to be taking, it made me go into the hospital for a week, and the antibiotics made me have an allergic reaction to them, and it was none of that is worth not doing treatments for me. If there's just the treatments are bigger than anything else for me now. Once I started doing my treatments, I've become, like, proud of the way I've made myself so healthy in, like, such a short span of time, and the treatments really helped me, like, grow this confidence with my CF. By doing my treatments, taking my pills, I've become so much stronger with my CF and telling people about it and being, like, open about it.
There's nothing harder for a parent than to not be able to feed their child. It's a huge feeling of failure when it seems like such a basic thing to feed your child and not being able to do it. And so to make the decision to get a feeding tube almost feels like you're admitting defeat. We couldn't do this. We couldn't make it work. And when it's such a basic thing, it can be a horrible feeling to not be able to get them to eat. But the feeding tube, it's a blessing because it allows you to give them that nourishment. And so for us, the feeding tube was the right decision to make for Colin. My hope for Colin is he's starting kindergarten next year. So we're really working towards the goal of him not needing to be tube fed while he's in school, because there's obviously a whole host of issues around having to do a tube feed at school, and we want him to feel like he fits in with the rest of the kids as much as possible. He already has cystic fibrosis, so his life is already different. But we want to eliminate one other piece of what makes him different from other kids and let him eat with everybody else.
I have to eat my food so I get big and strong. Oh, look how strong I am.
When I was younger, I was at a different CF center than I am now. And, I wasn't compliant. They would tell me do this, do that, and I didn't really do it. And that was kind of it. You know, every time I'd go into clinic, it was, are you doing this? No. Well, you should. Okay. You go home. And then when I ended up moving here, I started with a new clinic, and this is started the same process. And this time, though, the doctors didn't just, well, you should, and let me go home and not do it. They were, well, why aren't you doing it? Well, because I don't want to. Well, do you understand why we ask you to do this? Do you understand the benefits of what we're asking of you? The benefits from the treatment? No, not really. I don't know what any of this does. Okay, well, sit down, take a look at this CAT scan. Take a look at, you know, this literature. Let's talk about this. And made me kind of open my eyes and said, oh, there's a purpose to this. Like, I really do have a little bit of control here, you know? Maybe I can take back some of my life and be a little healthier. And so that's what I did. I started being healthier. I started being more active and social, and I did end up meeting my husband now. We met and we dated, and he was with me through when I still did have down periods. He was with me through that. And he's been a huge support, keeping me motivated. He's a huge reason why I want to stay healthy, is because I love our marriage, and we just bought a house. We have two little puppies. It's awesome. So I actually have all the things I never thought I would have. So it was a combination of motivation and support from someone who loved me, and knowing what to do and why to do it, and seeing the time doing it as a valuable time spent. So that really changed everything. And I wouldn't be this happy if I was sick all the time, you know? I mean, yeah, I take care of myself, and it takes a lot to do that. It's a lot of work, but it's totally worth it.